You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Linguist and political theorist Noam Chomsky has been called the greatest living intellectual. Chomsky is a harsh critic of U.S. foreign policy, drawing attention to atrocities committed by the CIA for the sake of U.S. economic interest. In a recent speech at the University of Texas at Austin, Noam Chomsky was asked about the possible nuclear threat from North Korea and about the fear U.S. officials are creating about a nuclear threat from Iraq.
There's an effort to conjure up fear here because they're dead set on a war and they want to divert people away from what's going on here and they want to take over those resources. It's got nothing to do with nuclear weapons. In fact, if they care, just think it through for a second. Suppose that anybody really took seriously what they're saying. Okay, let's believe it for a moment. Suppose that Saddam Hussein is developing weapons of mass destruction and we got to get rid of him, we got to destroy him and destroy not just hold him back with inspectors, but destroy him and get rid of the weapons of mass destruction and gain access to Iraqi oil. A really trivial way to do it, which isn't discussed. And we could ask why. It's a lunatic idea. I'm not suggesting it. But it's less lunatic than what's being proposed, and it's never discussed, and it would answer all these problems in no time. Encourage Iran to invade Iraq. Okay? Encourage Iran to invade Iraq. If they need any help, give them some logistic help and maybe bomb from a distance or something. Perfect solution. I mean, if Iran takes over Iraq, they'll tear Saddam Hussein to shreds. They hate him. They'll destroy every weapon of mass destruction, not only of his, but of any successor regime, because it's the main thing that they're scared of. There won't be any American casualties. There won't be any Israeli casualties. They'll be happy to give the U.S. access to the oil. They have much better credentials than we do. Remember, the guys in Washington were supporting Saddam Hussein right through his worst atrocities, right past everything they're now accusing him of, like gassing Kurds and stuff. They continue to support him and provide him with weapons of mass destruction. You obviously can't trust those guys. That's like trusting Saddam Hussein. On the other hand, the Iranians have perfect credentials. They were his victims. The U.N. isn't going to be any problem, There won't be terrorists. It won't inspire terrorist attacks in the West the way the CIA is predicting. So what's the matter with it? This perfect solution. Why doesn't anybody talk about it? Because the reason they don't talk about it is that the proposed reasons are irrelevant. I mean, there's a downside to this. It wouldn't leave the U.S. in control of Iraq's resources. It wouldn't be able to break up OPEC and set production and price levels. It wouldn't give the U.S. a lever of world control. It wouldn't divert the American population from the attack against them that's being carried out by the Bush administration. So it's of no use. And therefore, you don't see one commentator ever suggest it, although it's the obvious answer. And if you really take the argument seriously, it's a trivial way out. Perfect way out. But nobody will mention it because nobody takes the argument seriously. I mean, you don't have to even refute them. They don't take them seriously themselves. If they did, that's exactly what they'd be calling for. So there's other reasons, and the other reasons are, we can figure out.
For the record, linguist and political theorist Noam Chomsky does not advocate the overthrow of Iraq by Iran. He simply uses the allusion to show the White House seems more intent on war than on its stated goal of regime change or disarming Saddam Hussein. Chomsky spoke recently at the University of Texas at Austin. A special thanks to Shannon at Pacifica Station KPFT. Gopal Dayanini is the oil campaign coordinator for Project Underground, an organization dedicated to supporting communities resisting human rights abuses by the oil and mining industries. Dayanini says oil is the lifeblood of globalization, and anyone taking on human rights support work has to take on the oil industry. He believes there's a trail of oil leading from the Bush White House to the presidential palaces in Iraq.
This is not about the axis of evil. I think this is really about access to oil. And there's some pretty clear and obvious connections. First of all, the U.S. is about 5% of the world's population. We consume about the quarter of the world's oil, which is about 1.5 billion people's share of the world's oil supply. Given the fact that the U.S. only has 2% of the world's oil reserves and two-thirds of the world's proven oil reserves in the Middle East, you can see how important the Middle East oil supplies are to the United States.
Well, who is the largest supplier of U.S. oil at this time?
The largest supplier of U.S. oil at this time, it sort of fluctuates, but it's Canada is one of the largest suppliers to U.S. oil. Venezuela is a large supplier to U.S. oil. Saudi Arabia is a large supplier of U.S. oil. Iraq is, even under the sanctions, has been a favorite supplier of oil to the United States. If there was a regime change in Iraq, quote-unquote, and U.S. oil companies could have access to what are now state-owned oil operations in Iraq, that would significantly increase access to oil supply in the United States. Lawrence Lindsay, chief U.S. economic advisor to the administration, made it very clear when he said a regime change in Iraq would add 3 to 5 million barrels of production to the world oil supply each day. Basically, he said, you know, successful execution of this war would be, quote-unquote, good for the economy. And really, when folks in the administration talk about it being good for the economy, they're really talking about it being good for the oil companies. I think it's very frustrating to American oil companies that under the sanctions and under the U.S. Bombing and pressure on Iraq over the last 11 years, Iraq has signed deals with French and Chinese and Russian oil companies. U.S. oil companies have been left out. And the U.S. supported Iraqi National Congress, which is the opposition group that will likely make up the leadership of a new Iraq in the post-Saddam Hussein era if we don't stop this war.
So it's not that the reserves that the U.S. has access to are going dry. It's just that the oil companies in this country are angry or frustrated that they've been left out of the divvying up of the oil reserves in Iraq.
I think there's lots of overlapping interests. I mean, for one thing, if we don't curb U.S. oil consumption, we are going to increase by a third over the next 20 years, basically means that 70% of U.S. oil consumption is going to have to come from foreign sources. The U.S. has basically, since the 1800s, drilled itself dry, and we are really dependent on easy access to oil from other parts of the world. The more that we can control it, the more that, and by we, meaning transnational oil corporations, primarily those based in the United States, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, Unocal, Occidental, these kind of companies, the more stable that pricing is going to be and the easier that access is going to be for U.S. markets.
So what about OPEC? How does OPEC factor into this? I thought there was some sort of process in place whereby OPEC helped to determine the prices of oil throughout the world.
OPEC certainly does. I mean, OPEC is a consortium of nine oil-producing countries. Now, those they don't make up the bulk of the world's oil supply, but what they do make up is they're able to control pricing based on production and production outputs. Now, right now, I think the oil companies, as they consolidate more and more, as they merge more and more, and as they work closer and closer together, and particularly with the U.S. government, to gain access to more and more locations around the world, they're seeking to build a counter pricing scheme to OPEC. They would like to have oil prices controlled by transnational oil companies and not by oil-producing countries. And I think, right now, Saudi Arabia, which has by far the world's greatest amount of oil reserves and the greatest production, is unstable. And the U.S. sees this. Saudi Arabia is, in my mind, in a very similar situation to Iran just before the revolution. The Shah was entirely propped up by the United States and couldn't stand the weight of Islamist dissent.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia is in a similar situation, and I think Iraq is the easy place to station U.S. Troops and to gain access to oil that could actually defend against the fluctuation in Saudi output.
You assert in your article, Gopal, that the Bush administration is using this particular impending war with Iraq to carry out a grand scheme to lay oil pipelines to the West and to growing Asian markets. Is there any proof that such a scheme is actually in the works, any reports, any firsthand accounts or people involved in the planning, or is this just an educated guess, basically?
No, actually, I think, yeah, there's a lot of evidence. For one thing, just before, prior to the U.S. bombings of Afghanistan, there was a consortium called CentGas, of which UNICAL was a part of, and they were really seeking to run a pipeline through Afghanistan. That UNICAL pulled out of that after the U.S. began bombing in 98, and the CentGas consortium is back on its feet. I mean, I was surprised at how quickly the World Bank came out after the quote-unquote regime change in Afghanistan, saying that they would be willing to put World Bank funding into a pipeline through Afghanistan as a form of development. I mean, we're talking about a country that doesn't have access to potable water for a majority of the population, that has minefields strewn across its countryside, that has failing schools and failing hospital infrastructures. And what's being prioritized? Oil and gas pipelines. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that
pipelines leading to the West.
Pipelines leading to ports in the Gulf of Arabia to feed both the West and Indian growing oil markets in India. There's already, I mean, there's pipelines across the Caspian and into Turkey that have been pursued by Chevron, Texaco, and Shell and ExxonMobil over the last several years. There are military bases in all of the countries surrounding Afghanistan. The former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan had a bumper sticker saying, happiness is multiple pipelines. I think the U.S. has been very explicit about its oil interests in Central Asia and the Middle East. They're not actually claiming that this isn't about oil. They're just claiming that it's not just about oil, that it's also about terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, claims that are, quite frankly, unsubstantiated.
An activist from Texas who's been holding a hunger fast in front of the White House, Diane Wilson, says if Saddam Hussein had broccoli growing underground instead of oil, we wouldn't be planning to bomb Iraq.
I think if Saddam Hussein had broccoli growing underground instead of oil, we probably wouldn't have been funding his dictatorship for all those years, and we wouldn't have been turning a blind eye to his atrocities around the world. The U.S. has been supporting repressive regimes around the world to secure access to oil for as long as the U.S. has been dependent on oil. Now we're talking about the U.S. support for repressive regimes in Indonesia. Under the argument, the war on terror, the Bush administration immediately pushed for a $98 million aid package to Colombia to train Colombian military troops to defend Occidental's pipeline to that country, and they got $94 million, and U.S. Military training operatives are already on the ground in Colombia. Now, this is to defend the pipeline of a company that has admitted to paying off the forces that the U.S. is now calling terrorists. So you can see, I mean, it's not just Colombia. ExxonMobil was facing a human rights lawsuit from the people of Aceh, Indonesia, based on its complicity with abuses by the Indonesian military.
Of course, there's Nigeria as well.
And as well as facing, and Chevron is facing lawsuits in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. ExxonMobil asked the State Department to issue a brief, and the State Department did so, basically saying that this lawsuit could hurt Indonesia's position in the war on terror and therefore should be thrown out, and it was. And about a month after the lawsuit was thrown out, ExxonMobil got a $50 million contract to provide lubricants to the U.S. military.
What's the Cheney-Enron plan about, in a nutshell?
The Cheney-Enron plan?
Yes.
I think it's the Cheney-Enron-Halliburton-Chevron Exxon plan.
Yeah, that's the one.
The simple fact of the matter is Dick Cheney knows who his interests are and sat down with all of those folks and came up with a comprehensive national energy policy that involves drilling and killing around the planet that involves increased nuclear and coal development. And it's not to provide for U.S. energy needs, but really to provide for U.S. energy company profits. I'll give you a really good example. When Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense in under the Bush senior administration, there was a war against Iraq that resulted in 12 years of sanctions and U.S. bombings. Halliburton made $24 million off of the sale of oil equipment to Iraq between 1998 and 1999 during the sanctions through its subsidiary companies around the world. Now he's, and that was when he was CEO of Halliburton after leaving.
How did Halliburton make that amount of money off of that war against Iraq?
So under the sanctions, Iraq was allowed to use some of its oil monies to rebuild its oil infrastructure. Halliburton, the world's largest oil servicing company, got a lot of those contracts.
What a coincidence.
Exactly. Halliburton also happens to own Kellogg Brown and Root, which is the company that builds military bases and military servicing for the U.S. government and actually runs bases in Afghanistan and in Central Asia and is likely to run bases in Iraq if there is a U.S. invasion of Iraq. Now, this is a company also owned by Halliburton whose contracts with the U.S. government increased tremendously under Dick Cheney's leadership of the company. Just an interesting note, when Dick Cheney left Halliburton to come back to the White House, his departing package amounted to $36 million. So we can, you know, you can say that the money that they made off of Iraq, that was a consequence of the war, you know, pretty much went straight to his pocket.
It sounds like the Bush administration, between the military-industrial complex and the oil industry, they've got pretty much all of those bases covered.
No, absolutely. And there's such an overlap between those bases. I mean, with Halliburton owning military contractors and the oil company servicing and Exxon servicing the military, you can see how all of the overlaps exist. 41 of the top U.S. Administration officials have close ties to the oil company. Condoleezza Rice has a tanker named after her from Chevron. It goes on and on. The Condoleezza. Yeah, it was her parting gift after leaving the board of Chevron.
Gopal Dayanini is the oil campaign coordinator for Project Underground, an organization dedicated to supporting communities resisting human rights abuses by the oil and mining industries.
Anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you. To keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution.
I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Here we go now.
I go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. To fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
for a place to attack. Why not attack Iraq? They've got coconut and palm oil and crude. They invaded Kuwait, so let's not hesitate. We can blow up a country or two. If it's oil or it's Greece, we don't have time for peace. Waging war is what we want to do. Oh,
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody!
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back row romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil. It's gonna be a great fight. Should only take a fortnight to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Dana Lyons, Lubricate the Red, White, and Blue. Well, as the nations of the world appear to move closer to supporting an attack on Iraq, we thought it would be interesting to look back at a chapter in our past for any lessons to be learned, a time when the U.S. was engaged in a war against another smaller nation. On February 4, 1968, at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke eloquently about America's imperialistic tendencies. Though King was addressing the war in Vietnam, the words are chillingly appropriate today.
We all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that sex was the dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, this desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And you know, we begin early to ask life to put us first. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention. And all through childhood, the drum major impulse or instinct is a major obsession. They have innately the drum major instinct. Now, in adult life, we still have it, and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and you know, we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life, and you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. And somehow this warm glow we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of the vitamin A to our ego. Nobody is unhappy when they are praised, even if they know they don't deserve it and even if they don't believe it. The only unhappy people about praise is when that praise is going too much towards somebody else. But everybody likes to be praised because of this real drum major instinct. Do you know that a lot of the race problem grows out of the drum major instinct, a need that some people have to feel superior, a need that some people have to feel that they are first and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first. They have said over and over again, in ways that we see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result of this perverted use of the drum major instinct. It's led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. I mean, not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if something doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around, because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blunderings of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds, with everybody wiped away in every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is where we are drifted, and we are drifting there because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America, because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. Yes. Every now and then I go back and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And when I come and look at America, I say to myself, the parallels are frightening.
The late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, February 4th, 1968. Special thanks to Lona Elias, Peace Watch editor from WPFW in Washington, for that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA and Josh Chaffin. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.